back to Anime Death Spiral, the only anime podcast to once again get snubbed by Jeff Keighley and the Game Awards. 2 years in a row now, they keep ignoring my letters, all of my submissions, all of my arguments that, yes, podcasts are video games and deserve Game of the Year nominations.
Okay, I thought we agreed we weren't going to just air our grievances this close to Christmas. That's more of a New Year's thing.
No, what is Christmas for but the airing of grievances, huh?
You know, that's Festivus.
Oh, right. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry to all my New York friends out there. I didn't mean to step on your traditions.
You know, we don't have the Festivus bush out, so you're going to have to hold on to your grievances until then.
Well, it's just I'm so mad because I wrote this acceptance speech 2 years ago. I've been sitting on it. I really believe in the impact of our podcast and our opinions and the millions of followers that we definitely have backing us. They all voted for us. All of it ignored. So you know what? I'm sorry. I don't want to bring down. I don't want to bring down the vibe, bring down the room this close to the holidays. But Jeff Keighley, you're on my list. You're at the top of the list now.
What must be done to topple over this conservative regime at the top of video game awards? The injustices.
They didn't even show our trailer. They didn't even show our trailer at the end. And we paid a lot of money to have that made.
Yeah, and kind of the only point is to show trailers.
Well, that is, you know, cutting beyond the joke. That the Game Awards is just a big commercial, you know. It's literally like 15 seconds of actual award ceremony, which don't matter. Like, I think we've said it plenty on this show. Awards aren't real. Industry award ceremonies aren't like a real thing that you need to pay attention to or care about.
I think we need to like workshop an even edgier, more cynical take on it. Because like that is just like the standard understanding of what the Game Awards
are. How could we go more cynical? Like Game Awards are, well, see, I was about to say Game Awards are detrimental to the culture of game development, but that's
no,
not.
People already believe
yeah, people
that.
Already believe that. That's what people already believe.
We got to take it further. Like, the Game Awards actually exist in order to suppress any expectation of video gaming as a medium overall.
The Video Game Awards are a psyop to keep games at a lower class of cultural relevance and importance than they deserve to be.
Exactly. Jeff Keighley's only mission in life is to convince us that games are not art.
See, that's not cynical enough because people already think that about Jeff Keighley.
That's it. It is his function in the culture. It's true. Is to like suck all artistry out of the medium and just really just put on the most crass commercialist spin on the entire thing. It's true. And he doesn't deny it.
No. In fact, he celebrates it. It's kind of like his whole thing.
Yeah. It's his whole deal.
Cause
that's why I think he's so friendly with Kojima. Because Kojima sort of like in horror recognizes a piece of himself in Jeff Keighley, in that, you know, Kojima is desperate to like worm his way into the good graces of like film stars and directors. And Jeff Keighley is just so desperate to like worm his way into the favor of Kojima.
Is this like layers of Renfield going on? He's like one step
absolutely
below.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, Jeff Keighley is Kojima's Renfield. He's a little sniveling sycophant.
Yes.
Who does anything he says. You know what's funny is actually, you know, people talk a lot about how the Game Awards is like, oh, they're so desperate for legitimacy. They want to be the Oscars of video games, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I hate that phrase. I hate even hearing it.
It's terrible. But if you've watched the Oscars recently, you know that the Oscars are becoming the Game Awards of movies. Like the last Oscars, they just stopped and showed a bunch of fucking trailers for Marvel movies. And they had a like, what was that, last year or the year before, they just stopped down the whole show to show a clip from The Flash.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
I did not watch them live, but I remember hearing about it. But like, do you really expect me to watch the fucking Oscars? Come on.
That's Game Award shit.
At a certain point, it is going to be cut down so much, like the Game Awards, where it's going to be 80% just new Marvel and Star Wars trailers, and then like flash clips of like compilation clips of the people accepting their envelope. They don't even get their name read out. They just take the envelope and go back to their seat.
No, it's going to be like, they're going to do the in memoriam, but it's going to be picture in picture, and it goes down to a little tiny square while they play trailers for like the new Disney live action movie.
Now
Moana 3.
Actually, I'm imagining more. It's going to be picture in picture, like you said, but the trailer is going to be down in the corner, and on the big screen, it's just going to be like footage of people playing Subway Surfer. and there's going to be big robot narrated subtitles over the whole thing.
Movies suck. Movies are bad. Movies are bad and they suck. What are we doing?
That's why I think it's funny when people say, like, oh, again, back to Kojima. It's like, oh, his games are like movies, right? He wants to make games into movies. And first of all, he's already been doing that. Those are just the type of game that he's been making, a quote-unquote emphasis on cinematic experience is what I was trying to say before I stumbled over myself. But it's like, we've all thought about it. You and I have thought about it quite a bit. Any movie, like if Kojima ever actually makes a movie, anything he makes is bound to be one of the worst things ever put on film, because not only is it going to be relentlessly derivative of all of the weird like 80s and 90s schlock that he's obsessed with, he doesn't fundamentally understand what makes those movies enjoyable, even in an ironic sense. He does not know why he likes movies, but he is obsessed with trying to become a filmmaker. He doesn't,
an auteur,
but he doesn't, it's like I don't know, he's like a caveman who found alien tools, right?
you mean Guillermo del Toro is his Prometheus?
Yes. Guillermo del Toro came down from Hollywood heaven and passed on the knowledge of filmmaking to Kojima and damned him to all time to mediocrity and ridicule.
I think Kojima has something interesting in him. I'm not sure he has the tools to express himself in a filmic way. And I think that's not necessarily because he couldn't put a coherent narrative together, like in a general sense. But I think if you've ever watched a 4-hour Metal Gear Solid cutscene, you understand that he can't edit himself at all. He can't cut, which is, as we know from Battleship Potemkin, the single most important element of film ever created is the cut.
Hey, you know, you can just like stop filming here and then start filming something else, and then you put them next to each other and it creates like a scene.
It's wild that
Metal Gear Solid 4 is my Battleship Potemkin.
Well, it's like it's strange. It's always strange to me to think that this is the same guy, you know, who comes from, if he was talking about himself as a filmmaker, would be coming from the same filmic tradition of like Yasujiro Ozu, you know, a guy who like has like 4 words in his entire fucking movie. Meanwhile, the last Metal Gear Solid game had probably like a solid hour and a half where a guy just monologues at you. Oh my God. He's the Mike Flanagan of video games.
Oh, shit.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. You've cracked this thing wide open.
Oh, no. And instead of Stephen King being his muse, it's Tom Clancy.
Yes.
Wow.
Oh, that makes so much sense when you put them together like that.
That's wild. That is wild.
That said, I would absolutely be on board for the Netflix high budget miniseries of Metal Gear Solid. directed by Mike Flanagan, not Kojima.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
It's funny you mention that because I did watch some stuff this week.
Oh, shit. Really?
On Netflix, even.
Oh, okay. All right.
I know. It's a surprise after all the shit talking.
Something besides Dan to Dan, I'm assuming.
I watch that with my watch partners, so I usually leave that off the list. But I did some solitary watching. You could even say I watched in solitude.
Like some kind of freak?
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been watching a lot of different things. I don't know if you've paid attention at all to some of the stuff that's going on TV these days. We are clearly in a bit of a desert. But I started watching that Dune prophecy show.
Oh, yes. Dune prequel.
Yeah, it's all about a guy trying to destroy feminism, which is pretty wild.
Just like the Game Awards.
Yeah, exactly. So Dune Prophecy, I don't know if you know this, but Dune Prophecy is about how the Pope of feminism is evil. And Shai Hulud has created the ultimate men's rights Terminator to destroy it. Did you know that? That's the plot of Dune Prophecy.
Now, is this like fully like made up, or is this based off of like the glossary of the index notes to Frank Herbert's original script?
I don't know. I really don't know. This is one of those things where in the grand tradition of Dune being an ultra epic, I believe Dune Prophecy is set something ridiculously stupid, like 10,000 years before the movies.
Good. That's one of my least favorite like sci-fi fantasy tropes, is just unimaginably like infeasibly large blocks of time in between major events, and people reference them as if they happened within like living memory or generational memory, right?
Yes.
You know, it's like Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic, the video game, takes place like 10,000 years before.
Yeah.
But everyone is still wearing the same clothes and using the same guns and yep, has the same vehicles. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Yes. And this is
my robot fantasy space wizard show doesn't make sense.
It does not make sense. I mean, Dune, it is exactly the same thing, where it's the same tech. Everybody's wearing the same clothes. Shit's all the same. And I know kind of part of it is that the Bene Gesserit, the feminist pope, are like their entire plot is to control the next 10,000 years of human evolution by themselves, right? That's the entire plot of Dune.
Well, the plot of Dune is that Paul is their accidental like messiah. Like, he wasn't supposed to be the messiah, but someone fucked somebody they weren't supposed to, and then we got Muad'Dib,
little mouse Muad'Dib. And these nasty women. And of course it's like, well, was it a mistake? Or was it destiny? Was it the endlessly turning wheels of fate? And that's kind of what the plot of this is like, hey, you know, like, what if like a bunch of crazy shit was put into motion like 10,000 years ago, and actually, even though you like grasp for control, none of your attempts will ever come to fruition, because like stuff just happens. You have no control. Stuff just happens.
They don't seem to realize that like stuff just happens sometimes, bro. You know,
stuff just happens.
You can't anticipate that.
But I do really hate when they're like 10,000 years in the future, the houses of Harkonnen and Atreides are butting heads. It's like, shut the fuck up. Oh my god.
Yeah,
the same two guys. Yeah, great, cool.
Well, it gives I don't know, doing stuff like that very obviously puts an air of stagnancy on the whole universe, right? It makes it feel less lived in to me.
Yeah, we've talked about this. It's small world syndrome.
Yeah, it's, you know, everybody in Star Wars has to be related to a Luke or Leia somehow, right?
Yeah,
everyone's a Skywalker. or whatever, or your favorite fantasy character is actually, you know, Destiny Child.
Destiny Childs.
They're all Destiny children.
Destiny's child. Yes.
I don't know. It makes the world feel more constricted. It's like, if you're going to make Dune set 10,000 years ago, especially if it's not based on any established canon, if they're just winging it, why not make it take place on a different planet? Why not make Arrakis be like terramorphically different than it was, than the way we see it in Dune?
Yeah, what if it was that ocean planet from Interstellar?
And McConaughey just showed up.
Yeah, and Shai-Hulud was like a massive leviathan creature, and it was just swimming through the ocean, swallowing people up and giving them like psychic powers.
We could call it Wave.
Yeah. That would be, or we call it
Dune colon Waterworld.
Dune colon Ishmael. The Ishmael
prophecies.
Listen,
why don't we do a readaptation of Moby Dick set on a water planet where a techno pirate has to hunt a giant albino sandworm that's in the water. It's a water worm.
That's already an anime.
That's already an anime?
Yeah, they've done Water Planet and Airship Planet.
Oh.
Those are both things already.
Okay, dang. Yeah. I don't know. Lava Planet. Let's do Lava Planet.
Lava Planet would be sick.
Yeah.
And Shai-Hulud is some kind of
giant lava worm.
Baphomet.
Yeah.
A Bahamut. A great chaos dragon.
Volcanoes are just holes where the Shai-Hulud pokes up from the earth. Hey, it writes itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And volcanoes, you know, you feed them virgins or whatever, and that's like feeding Shai-Hulud the Destiny's Childs.
Yeah, exactly. And then have that like subtly tie in to events that will happen later on, but maybe like in 40 or 50 years, not 10,000.
Yeah. You know what? If you have to do 10,000, at least call them like Horkinins.
Yeah. Have language degradation
like
be a thing.
Atrodials. Atrodilize.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like at least give us that, you know, like. Come on.
Or, you know, at least use like weird archaic spellings and pronunciations. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. House Carino doesn't have to be House Carino. It could be House Corlano. Corlanus.
Or we get like, you know, two houses marry into each other and they combine their names. And it's like, oh, that's how we got the name Carino. It's a combination of two different, totally unrelated house names previously. Something like that. I don't know. We shouldn't be doing their jobs for them. This is, and I say this with conviction, should be the job of the feminist pope to come up with these ideas, not ours.
Yeah, well, the feminism pope, I mean, she is doing all the DNA manipulation, the gene editing and human eugenics project, the 10,000-year human eugenics project, which is, again, wild that the pope of feminism is the bad guy of this show, but also the main character. It's kind of bold in that way. I kind of like that aspect of it. It's sort of like, what are you guys doing?
It's a villainous anime.
Yeah, it's definitely a villainous anime.
Okay, all right.
It's kind of wild in that way. I'm liking it more than the Penguin, for sure. It's mm-hmm, way better mm-hmm. than that. In fact, I'm liking it more than the Dune movies. I think it's better than the movies.
You know, at the end of the season, the Bene Gesserit is looking out the window from her penthouse after she's killed all of her enemies, and she says, "I've done it. I'm the most powerful one." And then a light comes on in the distance, and it's just a picture of Timothy Chalamet superimposed above the clouds.
It'll be like, I've finally done it. I've eliminated the universe of Paul Atreides's, and then one little desert mouse will hop across the screen, and it'll be like, oh no, we know what's coming.
Madib, there he is.
10,000 years later. Honestly, the audacity of that, just the audacity of it.
Yeah.
Like, come on. Anyway, I watched that a little bit of that, but, you know, the thing I watched that really blew me away, which, you know, doesn't happen that often. You hear about this little thing, called 100 Years of Solitude? You know this thing? Cien Años de Soledad? You ever heard of this?
You know, I'm going to say I'm familiar with the title. Not super familiar with the source material or the Netflix adaptation. What's going on here?
Wow. Well, not to put College Boy to shame, but this is one of the most important magical realist novels of, you know, the last 150 years, really. A book by Colombian author Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I think it's of it as sort of in the tradition of, like, Dickens in a way. It is a both a sprawling epic of a book about sort of like a multi-generational stories, much like Dune, spanning
10,000 years.
10,000 years, basically. You know, three generations, 10,000 years, roughly.
Yeah, that makes
four
sense.
Four or five generations, maybe.
Uh-huh.
But also, it's a story that's incredibly intimate with its characters. We explore really interesting, like, ground-level character work, which is just fantastic. It's constantly, like magical realism, like literary fiction, magical realism sort of exists as an underpinning of making the metaphorical literal in a playful way, right? So it constantly will be referencing the real world and keeping a toe grounded in the real world. But then every once in a while, it'll offhandedly be like, oh yeah, but like alchemy exists in the Philosopher's Stone or whatever. And that'll just kind of be like in the background.
Okay.
Magical realism is a really interesting way to say elevated fantasy, I guess, you know?
Well, I've always kind of wondered what is the strict, like, delineation between fantasy and magical realism. Is magical realism just fantasy, but set in our presumably, like, real world, but just with magic? Whereas, like, you know, something like classical fantasy or high fantasy is Lord of the Rings, where it's, you know, a different universe, a different world that they inhabit that is similar and possibly based off of our reality, but is not the same thing.
I think magical realism is an interesting concept because before, and this is something like you can find Ursula K. Le Guin or like Jorge Luis Borges writing about, in that there was a time before the genreization of fiction, right? Mm-hmm. In the time of like Borges, who was definitely one of the first Central and South American Latin fiction writers who kind of ended up as the pillars of magical realism, they referred to themselves and works similar to theirs as fantasy and themselves as fantasists. But they were not writing in the Tolkienian mode, right? Like, mm-hmm. A lot of this stuff was happening before any of that. And a lot of it had to do more like parables, I would say. They have more in common with like a parable than an elf or an orc, you know?
Sure.
There's a really famous Latin American short story. I forget whose name, but this is the one that always comes to mind. It's written in the first person, and it's about this academic who lives in, I think, Argentina, maybe somewhere like that. And he's writing about his experience of going to his friend's place for dinner and meeting his wife. And his friend is constantly talking about his wife as kind of being very wild, right? Very full of life, wild, it's hard to control.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Kind of, you know, in a lot of seemingly kind of misogynistic ways. And the first time he sees her, he immediately falls in love, until later in the night he gets drunk and his friend gets drunk and they ended up staying too late. And a giant panther comes down the stairs and he realizes from the panther's jewelry that it is the wife. Right. And he goes on to write about, you know, how this is a little weird, but, you know, sometimes women are panthers. And like that is parabolic. Can I say parabolic?
Parabolic.
And that's closer to like the magical realist take. In 100 Years of Solitude, it is a story about the development of Latin America and it's not the taming of Latin America so much as the subjugation of Latin America. It's little stories like these, kind of vignettes that link together the lives of this one intergenerational family. And it's told in, like I said, a very intimate but epic way, in a sort of that Dickensian way, where it's sort of sprawling, but at the same time, we're spending a lot of times like internally with these characters. It's really, really fascinating, weird, powerful stuff. The book is sort of in the tradition of like a Jorge Luis Borges style, or like a Roberto Bolaño. Should I even ask if you?
No, don't even ask, dude. I didn't read. I didn't go to college to read.
God damn it. How am I not? I don't have the degree here. Oh my God. Anyway, the Netflix show is a complete Latin American production, which is really strange. We just talked incredibly cynically about this entire Netflix project, but the fact that they gave a show and like a clearly a pretty prime time budget to a purely Spanish language, like Latin American production of a central pillar of like Latin American magical realist literary fiction is strange, I guess. Is that the word? It's weird.
Strange as in unexpected? As in
like, that's something that happened? Of all the things that could happen, that happened? I mean, I was just talking about The Penguin. That's what's going on over on HBO, is they're making fucking Penguin movies, right? Mm-hmm. Penguin television shows. Prestige television about the backstory of the Penguin from Batman. And every once in a while, they do an adaptation of 100 Years of Solitude. And you know what? The adaptation is really good. Some of the best shit I have seen in a really long time.
You know, I think that just is a symptom of Netflix's own unique production style, which is, I think that they just cynically hand out money to whoever can hold the executive's attention for longer than 15 seconds. You know, they're literally, the Netflix pitch process is literally you get shoved into a room with the higher ups while they're doing lines of coke and say, what do you got? Come on, we need content. And you just hand them a script. And as long as they understand the first five words, then yeah, all right, here, have money, go do whatever. And then they just do that for like 5,000 different people. And eventually one of them, you know, is gonna return something good. But, you know, we were talking about context of historical facts before the start of the show. You have to consider the context that Netflix creates a lot of crap, like a lot. And it gets mostly filtered out. And all we see is that cream of the crop, stuff like this that you're talking about. And oftentimes what people call like the good stuff on Netflix these days is still like pretty mediocre overall.
That's generous.
So when something like this gets made, have no mistake, it is an anomaly. It's an anomaly that you're seeing, a quirk of their haphazard funding like structure. And so I wouldn't put too much thought into figuring out why Netflix is the one making this. It could have been anyone. It's just the way that they make their shows made it slightly more likely to happen to them, right?
It definitely feels like this is one of those very strange things where like Netflix's approach to just like shotgun everything ended up creating something that otherwise would never have existed in this form.
I'm just saying, like, for every 100 Years of Solitude, they've been tossing millions of dollars at like comedians for another Joe Rogan or Dave Chappelle stand-up special.
Well, it's Matt Rife now, right?
You're sure, Matt Rife.
10,000 Years of Solitude.
Yes.
Yeah, I've been watching this. I just want to mention something that's actually like jaw-droppingly interesting and weird and really well done, and actually done in a respectful way, which is super rare, because this is like not the kind of thing that gets done this way, especially because, you know, Gabriel García Márquez specifically refused to sell the screen rights to this novel because he knew somebody was going to try to make like a fucking white version of it, you know. This was loosely adapted against Marquez's specific instructions by a guy called Shuji Terayama, a fairly well-known Japanese New Wave filmmaker. He's really well-known for the adaptation that became... He called it Farewell to the Ark, and this is a fairly well-known Japanese... Well, it's not an adaptation. Legally, it is not an adaptation. It is... you can't say it's an adaptation, but let's say loosely based. It's a film loosely based on the book. And I think this is really interesting because Shuji Terayama, check this out, also wrote music.
Oh.
In fact, he wrote the theme song for Ashita no Joe.
No way.
Yes way. He wrote the theme song for classic anime Ashita no Joe, as well as some other theme songs for other anime. And the song lyrics for the Nutcracker Fantasy, which is the Christmas connection. But I wanted to make the anime adaptation. This is my way to dismount from the literary fiction Netflix adaptation I wanted to talk about. So we passed through Shuji Terayama back into anime. We're still in Netflix though, because guess what? I did watch anime, and I did watch anime on Netflix.
You watched a Netflix anime? Okay.
Yeah. Not Dan to Dan. We don't need to talk about Dan to Dan. We'll talk about Dan to Dan when the season's over. But you know how we feel about it. I want to talk about something that I mentioned last episode. I watched Mononoke.
Yes. You charged me with watching that as well. And I didn't. I'll just say it up front. I didn't watch it.
I didn't watch it.
So you go on. But it's fine because, as you told me, it's a part one anyway. And, like, to be perfectly honest, I don't watch part ones. I only watch complete stories. I didn't watch any of the Lord of the Rings movies until 30 years after they came out.
Yeah, and all at once, too. You're going to sit there. I'm going to do 9 hours straight. That's the only way I can do it.
It's how the filmmakers envisioned it, okay?
Yeah. So when part two of Mononoke comes out, you'll just sit and do like all 4.5 hours or whatever. Actually, this one's not that long.
I'll sit like in A Clockwork Orange with the things in my eyes doing the Ludovico treatment.
Hey, why not? Whatever gets you across the finish line.
Okay, what is up with the Mononoke movie part one?
The Mononoke movie part one is 89 minutes long.
Oh, tight little film.
Yeah.
Sub 90, already earning points.
Absolutely. And that's what you want. The episodes of the show are like 24 minutes long. So you can really feel them stretching their legs here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. Frankly, I'm going to have to watch this one again because I did find this confusing. Now, the series itself is, I think, a little bit infamous for being, I want to say, it has a tendency to obfuscate its own meaning.
I think the word you're looking for is inaccessible.
I don't think it's inaccessible. I think even if you weren't interested in truly like puzzling out what is happening in each Mononoke episode, and they're not all super dense and impenetrable. Some of them are just straightforward stories. One of them's actually just like a murder mystery, which is kind of cool. But some of them are like highly interpretative, and they use a lot of really interesting, let's say, almost anti-narrative techniques in order to paint more of like a poetic attempt at filmic narrative.
It's impressionistic.
Sometimes it gets very impressionistic. And I found that they lean into that really hard in this movie. Mononoke the movie, Phantom in the Rain.
Oh, well, it's about a phantom in the rain. I can already tell that.
There is a phantom and it does seem to be in the rain. I can definitely tell you that for sure.
Okay, well, I mean, that's a pretty strong start. I don't see what's confusing about that.
Yeah, it's interesting because they call this a supernatural psychological horror film on Netflix.
And called it a survival crafting horror RPG on Steam.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I agree with that. I'm not sure if I told you, hey, let's watch a supernatural psychological horror film tonight, you might be a little disappointed if I put on Mononoke the movie.
I mean,
at the very least, you might be a little confused by what I meant.
I mean, this is a very personal take, but I am no longer surprised by anything you in particular put on the screen, no matter how you describe it. I've been swooshed and zagged too many times by your picks to have any kind of preconceived notions.
I got a couple more tricks up my sleeve. We could go some places. You know, this is still Mononoke. We've got the medicine cellar, and we've got ghosts, and there's like sort of a supernatural element to it. I can promise you, he does go Super Saiyan by the end, and there's a cool fight scene.
Okay.
So even though I'm talking about it like this, like, don't get intimidated. Like, it's still fucking cool shit.
At the end of the day, it's still anime. Like, let's not get anything wrong here.
Yeah. Look, I don't want to oversell, like, this isn't a tone poem, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's no Cat Soup.
Yes, even though sometimes it sells itself that way.
I mean, I've always been, you know, peripherally aware of Mononoke as a series. I mean, its most memorable and striking thing to me, having not watched the series or the movie yet, is,
Jesus,
like,
Christ.
The art style is incredibly striking and very colorful and very cool looking, and almost has like a Klimt-esque quality to it in some ways.
Very much so. It's sort of a combination of Klimt and more traditional Japanese artworks.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. It's very like,
there's lots of wood cutting.
Yeah, like Showa era wood cutting kind of style, like the Great Wave, but set up against a glittering gold background kind of thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, very cool. I mean, I will always give it props for, like, oh, I can tell, like, that's Mononoke just by the art style.
When you watch an anime, what you're looking for is something that looks cool. I've always said this.
I've always said this about really any kind of visual medium. You want it to look good.
if you're going to sit down and spend a lot of time looking at a thing, it should look cool. It's got to look cool. I mean, what are you doing?
Well, okay, now there is a case that sometimes intentionality, is that a word? I'm gonna pretend it's a
intentionality?
Word.
Intentionality? Yeah, that's a word. Okay. That's definitely a word.
The intentionality of making something look bad can still make it look cool and good. So that adds a layer there. But this is not applicable here. This just looks really, really pretty. You know, go check it out. So tell me more about this Wet Phantom.
Well, the Wet Phantom is kind of a red herring for this first movie, I imagine, over the course of this story, which hopefully won't take too long to get the other parts out. I'm really hoping, because Mononoke did start in 2007, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but it is 2024 now.
Oh, shit. I've got something I gotta go do. Hold on.
Yeah. He'll be right back.
I'm late. It's been going on for a long time.
Well, no, the problem is it hasn't. It released one season of 12 episodes back in 2007, and then it did nothing until now.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Oh yeah, no, there was 12 episodes of Mononoke, 13 if you include the episode that appeared in the horror anthology Ayakashi Samurai Horror Tales, which is where the medicine cellar comes from. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's good. That's also very good. That's some good shit. You should watch that.
I'll have to add that to the list.
Yeah, that's some classic Japanese ghost story shit told in an anthology style where different directors did each story. So it's got like different art styles for each of the stories, and it just looks fucking, it looks great. It just looks really cool.
That's cool. I like when they do that.
It's like old. It's got that old, even though it came out in like 2006, it's got sort of an old school anime look to it, almost like a 80s style. So those people who are like, hey, the anime peaked in the 80s. This is the shit for you, because whoever was directing a lot of these episodes kind of agreed with you. But that's where the medicine seller came from. He was like the main character of, like, you know, episode 6 or whatever from that. And then the year after, I guess people were like, damn, that dude's so fucking cool. We need to make his own series. And that was where 12 more episodes came from.
Okay. Well, I mean, they just picked the most popular one. It makes sense to spin it off, right? It's a good business decision.
Of course.
Which, anime at the end of the day, is a business. We can never forget that. Don't ever forget that at the end of the day, it's all about the Benjamins.
Well, of course, anime is crass consumerism at its most fundament.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what ultimately determined it is the medicine seller story was maybe like the only one that's not just like straight up some fucking like canonical Japanese folk tale. You know what I mean?
It was an extrapolation on those themes, but it was an original story, not just a retelling of a like a legend or a folk tale.
Yeah, like the first episode of that was like the Yotsuya Kaidan, right? Which is about like the guy who meets the beautiful girl, and it turns out she's a ghost.
Right. Yes.
Classic story.
Well, she wants him to stay at her inn. He's like, no, I think you're a ghost. I shouldn't do that. And then he comes back the next day, and the people are like, hey, you didn't see a lady in the woods last night, did you? Because she's a ghost. And if you see her, you shouldn't stay at her house, even if she wants you to.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, classic mm-hmm. story. Everybody loves that.
I think
they
do that story in Mushishi as well, as one of the episodes.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, this is one of those things. It's like Robin Hood. They just, like, people just tell it in every fucking context they could possibly cram it into. It's mm-hmm. like one of those.
There is an episode of the 90s Grimdark Blackjack OVA series that was a take on the Ghost Woman story where she invites him back to her house and he has to perform surgery on a ghost. I like that one.
Oh, right. Yes. I like that one. That one's cool. I gotta perform surgery on this ghost.
My scalpels, they do nothing.
I didn't bring enough ectoplasm.
I need O positive ectoplasm, the universal donor.
We're gonna have to kill her sibling and then hook her ghost up to the IV.
We're gonna have to do a ghost transplant.
So that is where it comes from, and its stories are sort of in that mode. They're all very like classic kind of Japanese ghost stories, and the medicine seller is this mysterious character. He roams from story to story, wielding his sword of justice, which needs three elements in order to unsheath. He needs, what is it? Truth,
justice, and the American way.
No, that would, if only that, that would be easy. No, the problem is he needs truth, form, and reason, I think. Basically, he needs to identify the ghost, understand the scenario, and then get the truth out of everybody involved, which is very convenient because it sets us up for a incredibly classic detective story, which is, you know, this is the fundament of all detectives.
Yeah, so he's a ghost detective. He's not a medicine seller.
Yeah, but his name is Medicine Seller. So who are you going to argue with the man?
That's like going up to a doctor and like, hey, you're a doctor, right? It's like, no, my name is Doctor. I'm a police officer.
So your name is Doctor Who? No, I'm the doctor. It's not. So he stumbles around encountering ghost stories and solving them for people, usually in ironically tragic ways. And this becomes sort of a problem with the movie, because as you can imagine, if you only get the first part of a detective story, it's not exactly a great arc for a 90-minute film. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, you kind of want to have the, like, I would say probably the number one quality that you want to have in a detective story is an ending, preferably one that solves the mystery. I can't think of too many detective stories that are well beloved for having no ending or no resolution to the mystery. I think it's pretty much all of them that do that that I can think of.
Well, no, you're forgetting an incredibly, incredibly famous example.
Oh, what am I overlooking?
Anyway, I feel very strange about the movie because, as I just alluded to, there is no end. And in fact, there is no middle either. Things just kind of happen and we get a bunch of stuff. And in classic Mononoke fashion, everything is very obscured by a level of, artistic obfuscation. Which I don't necessarily hate. I like it quite a lot. It's beautiful. It's constantly interesting to look at and think about and try to interpret. But interpreting something like that without a middle or an end can be very frustrating. And I feel like that's what it left me with. A very acute sense of frustration, which doesn't mean you shouldn't go watch it. I think everybody should go watch it. It was fucking great. But it's hard to sit there and be like, what the fuck was any of that? What just happened? I don't understand.
All right. So you've brought a couple things to the table so far this episode that obviously have some very high pedigree of artistic and cultural and creative merit to them. You know, these are highbrow works, really heady stuff that take time to digest and think about. And
I always do.
Yeah. Well, yeah. No, that's why we have you on the show. It's why I pay you.
Who's we?
You know, me and the other guy.
Motherfucker.
And so I want to bring
Nate,
something.
I've invited you onto my show to talk about some anime. I understand you've brought a clip.
Oh yeah, here, it's right here. I'm gonna show it to all the people.
Great, and that was really good. That was really good stuff. Do you want to give us a little bit of detail about this Christmas anime you've been so enthusiastic about?
Yes, I do. Now,
thank you for joining us, by the way.
Oh, I it's a pleasure to be here. In fact, you know, it'd be great if I could leave, but you've locked the doors behind me for the last 90 episodes. You've not let me leave this room.
I'm gonna need a little bit more from you before you can take off.
So once again, I've scrounged up some anime to talk about here, and as I've been talking about the last couple episodes, I am in the Christmas spirit. We're in the Christmas season. I'm looking for the Christmas anime. And today I want to talk about a follow-up to the anime, the Christmas anime that I talked about on last year's Christmas episode.
No, we cannot do more Love Hina. I refuse.
No, not Love Hina. This is the other one.
Oh, phew. Okay.
This is, I watched Santa Department : Midsummer Merriment. Do you remember me talking about Santa Department?
No, I must have scrubbed it from my brain. Is this a particularly heinous entry?
It's not great. It's more bizarre than anything. Now, it does rely pretty heavily on the classic Christmas myth, which is, as we all know, that in the past, the three Santas came together and were concerned about the problem of overpopulation on the planet. You see, there were too many children being born for them to efficiently deliver presents to. This is the three Santas: Santa Claus, Père Noël, and Saint Nicholas. These are the three classic Santas. And they came together and they decided, we're going to incorporate...
Wait, hold on. When did they split into three guys?
Well, what do you mean? There's always been three Santas.
Is this some kind of holy trinity? Is this the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost?
Yes, but also no. This is more like a Cerberus of Santas. If you were to separate Cerberus into three separate dogs.
Do they share a jolly white beard between them, sort of like the three fates share an eyeball?
No, they more represent...
They pass it back and forth?
They're more like the Greek concept of the Furies or Hecate, right? They are three aspects of the one Uber clause.
Okay, I see. All right. Yeah. That makes more sense.
And so you have your fat, jolly one with the full beard, and then you have the short, gnomish looking one who wears glasses and kind of has his hair sticks up like he was caught in a laboratory explosion.
No. Mm-hmm.
And then you have the skinny one who has a chin beard and no mustache, and he's surfing Santa.
God, I hate that even more.
He's Bosozoku Santa with his tricked out motorcycle.
No!
I'm not making this up.
God damn it. I know the American conception of Santa is from a fucking Coca-Cola ad, but like, come on with this shit.
And so
there is a Santa.
And so they came together and the only thing they could do to, again, this is in response to global overpopulation, they incorporated the Santa duties into a business based in Finland for tax purposes, where they have three separate but equal branches of government. You see, they have the central Santa department, where their authority lies. They have the present department, which is, you know, mostly in charge of packaging and delivering the gifts on Christmas, but to offset costs during the non-Christmas season, they do fill a Amazon-like role, final carrier, like a post office role for online orders. And then they do have the Santa Security Department, which we're not going to call the SS. And that is
the SSD.
Yeah, that is the Santa Secret Service that is, you know, in charge of providing security for the Santas and their affiliates as they deliver presents on Christmas Eve, but also they do mercenary out their skills to world leaders during the non-Christmas season, and there is a intricate, you know, level of employee onboarding, let's say. I'm not going to beat around the bush. They do set up a world where Christmas is ubiquitous with the gig economy. And being one of Santa's elves, they're not called elves, they are gig workers. Like, they're just kids. And they are kids, they're underage.
They're children?
Yeah, they're underage.
These three Santas don't have elves, they just hire children?
That is correct, yes. Children who have to move into their special Santa training facility to learn how to be, you know, Christmas helpers.
Are they at least the naughty children?
No. These are, in fact, children who want to be there, I guess.
Are they orphans?
Is he
kidnapping orphans?
Well, let me set this up. One of our main character in this OVA episode, because this is a spinoff episode from the original Santa Department, The Secret of Christmas anime from 2009, I want to say. This is Midsummer Merriment. This came out in 2021. So kind of like Mononoke, big gap between entries in the series.
Uh-huh.
And the plot of this one, we start in on our main character, Mint, who is a middle school girl who wakes up in the middle of the night to find Santa in her room, hovering above her bed. By the way, in Japan, Santa doesn't leave presents under the tree. He comes into your room directly and leaves them, you know, by your bed.
By your bed?
Yeah, by your bed.
Not under the tree.
Not under the tree. And so it's not weird that this older man was sneaking around a girl's bedroom at night.
He sneaks into the girl's bedroom
to deliver presents, yes.
Not under the tree. He slips the present in her bed. Is she aware of this? Does she wake up?
Well, she wakes up and she's like, oh, hey, it's Santa. And I want to make it clear that this Santa, the one she's interacting with, is Surfin' Santa, by the way.
They sent Surfin' Santa?
Yeah, yeah. They sent a laid-back Osaka Santa to go do this round.
This is terrible.
She was like, "Hey, Santa, thanks for bringing me presents. Presents. It's so good to see you." He's like, "Hey, kid, go back to sleep. You're not supposed to be awake right now." And she's like, "Oh, okay. Well, have fun delivering presents. Oh, hey, by the way, that amulet you're wearing is so beautiful. Can I have it?" And he's like, "You got it, kid." And he
for Christmas?
Yeah. Yeah. So she shakes down Santa for his jewelry on Christmas Eve. And he surfs off into the sunset. And this is such an inspiring moment for her that she wants to go in and join the Santa Corps, you know, when she grows up. And when I say grow up, I do mean a year later when she's 13. And so the next, we get a time skip. She is in training at Santa department, at Santa HQ.
Santa HQ.
Yeah, Santa boot camp.
Right.
You know, she has a Narissa Sakura with her two friends, Noah from the Bible, who is also 13.
Noah.
And 13-year-old Thomas Edison. These are all characters. These are all characters that...
Hey, wait, he's not from the Bible.
Yeah, Noah Hold from the Bible and Thomas Edison from the Bible.
Hey, also, you know, Noah's Old Testament. That's like pre-Santa.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He's like Super Santa. He goes around delivering two of every animal to all the kids.
I mean, Noah did oversee the first extinction event of human life.
Yeah, no, it makes sense that he would be a vengeful Christmas spirit there ever after. And so...
Oh, this is going so wrong.
Yeah. Well, we haven't even got to the actual plot of the episode yet. And so Mint, our main girl, is walking on the beach after hoverboard lessons. By the way, did I mention the hoverboards?
These are the surfboards that Surf and Santa uses?
Well, no, Surf and Santa surfs on his sleigh. He's like driving the sleigh, but he just stands up in it and rides it like a surfboard.
Okay, so there are hoverboards, but he surfs on a sleigh.
That is correct. Yeah, you got it right. And so the hoverboards, the Back to the Future 2 style hoverboards, are for the gig workers, the child gig workers. They use those to deliver the presents in Santa's stead. Because remember...
Wait, hold on. Santa doesn't deliver the presents.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. Remember, the Santas Incorporated and collectively put their entire power and authority into a central government. And so that's why they need the child gig economy workers to go out and deliver presents for them now. They're too busy dictating the Santa Nation, which is Finland.
They're the premiers of Finland?
Well, yeah, they kind of had a corporate takeover of the country of Finland, you know, to more efficiently run the Santa state.
Did they end democracy?
Listen, you don't need democracy at the North Pole, we'd formerly known as Finland. You only need Christmas spirit and love and joy and full deference to the power of Santa. You know, it's a system that just works. You wouldn't understand, okay?
Where does the magic come in?
Well, you see, Thomas Edison, he has a sexy older uncle who works in Santa's inventing department, and he's in charge of making all of the magic, like, trinkets and gadgets that they use to enforce Christmas cheer globally.
So Thomas Edison is a magical craftsman? He crafts magic items?
Well, no, his sexy older uncle is. Thomas Edison is a little boy.
Is his uncle Tesla? Nikola Tesla?
That would be too beyond the pale.
That's too much?
Yeah, that's too much. No, they do what's the boar-headed guy from Demon Slayer? What's his name again?
It's been a long time since I read Demon Slayer.
It's the same gag. It's the same gag as that guy where, you know, the Tesla's sexy older uncle spends most of the episode with like a gas mask on and no one knows what he looks like. And then at the end, it gets knocked off and everyone's like, "Oh my God, he's sexy."
Right.
So we're just going to refer to him as older Edison. and Thomas Edison is you know a minor character at best.
I see. His name's Inosuke.
His name is Edison-san, if we want to get formal with it. And so she, Mint, our main character, is walking the beach. By the way, they're not in Finland for this episode. This is during the off season, so they're at the tropical Santa training facility in the Caribbean. Just want to establish that
offshore Santa facility.
Yeah, at the offshore Santa facility.
Yeah, would you say this is like some kind of outer heaven?
Yeah, where Santas are truly appreciated for their role in society. They're not thrown aside like garbage.
Finally, a place where we could be free.
Is this why we're still here? Just to be merry? And so she notices her other friend, Noah, from the Bible, picking up garbage on...
Noah.
Yep, Noah.
What's a cubit?
Oh, you're doing... And Noah's picking up trash on the beach, and she's like, "Hey, what's going on?" He's like, "It pisses me off so much that we spend all year giving out presents to people and they still litter." And then, unprovoked, a drunk man with no shirt on comes up to Noah and says, "Hey, kid, stop picking up trash. Don't you know that's useless?" And Noah's like, "Well, I think you're the one that's useless." And the guy's like, you got some attitude problem, kid. You're going to waste your life picking up trash. Which is objectively true. And so Mint's like, "Well, don't listen to that guy, Noah. I'm going to help you pick up trash, see?" And so they start picking up trash, but unbeknownst to them, this does in fact anger the evil spirit of Mook, who, as we all know, is the three Santas' ancient and ultimate enemy. The, you know, anti-Christmas, the Krampus, if you will. And it doesn't like that all of its trash is getting picked up off the beach because it wants a world filled with hate and dirtiness and litter on the ground. And so it forms... Uh-huh. You know,
some kind of snow miser.
Yeah. Well, a trash miser, you might call it, because
trash miser.
It you know, picks up all of the trash on the beach, inadvertently cleaning up the beach very quick. You know, much quicker than one preteen Noah from the Bible would be able to do. And so, all of this trash is then combined and held together with the evil spirit of anti-Christmas into a giant trash dragon. Very, you know, again, classic callback to the Christmas creation myth. We all remember the trash dragon that was there at the birth of our Lord Jesus Christ when Santa came.
That's your trash dragon reference?
Yeah, that's my trash dragon reference. You got another one?
Well, I think the most famous trash dragon is, of course, the one from Odin Sphere that crashed PlayStation 2s.
Was that dragon made of trash?
Yeah, it was a trash dragon. It spewed trash at you instead of fire out of its mouth. And when it did that, it would crash your PlayStation.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, right?
Yeah. Well, we're all working from the same shared mythology here, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, this all goes back to the same creation myths.
By the way, did I mention that the three Santas were the three wise men at the birth of Jesus? Because that goes without saying. Anyway, so in order to combat the trash dragon, Thomas Edison goes to Sexy Edison, his older uncle, who wears a gas mask and overalls and no shirt underneath, and says, you need to invent something real quick to fight this trash dragon with. And so he invents a like a Ghostbuster vacuum, right? You know, sure. it's a Ghostbuster laser, but instead of shooting a laser at ghosts to bust them, it does just suck up trash. And
trash sucker.
Yeah, a vacuum, some kind of super ghost vacuum, and they give these out to all of the gig workers, and they all suck up trash from the trash dragon, thus weakening it but not killing it. And so, as a final coup de grace, Sexy Edison busts out his Christmas spirit laser, you know, a destructive weapon of mass destruction powered by the Christmas spirit of the user, and gives it to Mint and says, you gotta shoot the dragon with your Christmas spirit. And she's like, got it. But it doesn't quite power up all the way, and she can't figure out, because no one's more Christmassy than her. I mean, Santa came into her room at night and gave her a special secret amulet that one time.
Right? Well, she could be Catholic. I mean, that would help.
Oh, well, the whole world's Catholic. That, I mean, come on.
This is a post-Catholic takeover world?
Yeah, this is post-Catholic singularity continuity.
Oh,
here.
Oh, shit, this is the Pope's fever dream?
Not the feminist post, the Catholic one.
The Catholic one, the more evil one.
Mm-hmm. And so finally she realizes that she has to activate the magical Christmas power of the amulet Santa gave her. To give the final burst of power to the Christmas laser and shoot the heart out of the trash dragon. And wouldn't you know it, that does it. But as one final twist, when the trash dragon explodes, all of the presents for the good boys and girls that it ate, which, by the way, that was its goal. I forgot to mention that. It did start eating all of the presents for the good boys and girls when it first formed. And so now it's
presents. The implication being that the presents are trash.
Yes.
They're trash presents.
It was kind of like a reverse recycler. It was turning good product into trash, you know, kind of a hyper accelerator of trash. And all of these presents started to plummet down towards the ocean, which would turn them into even more trash in the ocean, which is killing turtles. They wanted to make it very clear that was like the number one concern with trash in the ocean is that it's killing turtles. And
you know, it is killing turtles.
I mean, it is. So, yeah.
I mean, it's a valid concern.
Yeah.
It's killing other stuff too, but we don't care about that.
I mean, turtles are objectively the coolest animal in the ocean. No comment. Yeah. No further follow-up.
Yeah, they live a really long time until we strangle them with trash, of course.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, and I'm sure some of those turtles may deserve it. I can't comment on that.
You can't live 130 years without doing something to deserve death. But
die young or live long enough to become the villain.
Yes, as anime villains are constantly saying, they live life by a different morality.
And all of the, after the trash dragon explodes, all of the presents for the good boys and girls fall down into the, or they're falling down into the ocean. And then out of nowhere, Bosozoku Santa shows up on his Surfin' Santa mega sleigh and miraculously, you know, saves all of the presents from falling in the ocean. And then he's like, you got it, kid. You did it. You're going to be the next Santa. Although he doesn't say that because Mint is a girl and she can't be Santa. Girls can't be Santa because of the Catholicism. It all makes sense in world. You just got to watch it. You know,
she can't grow the beard.
Yeah, she can't grow a beard. And that is the end of the episode. And it ends on a splash screen letting us know that the whole thing was funded by the goddamn Japanese anti-ocean littering committee. The whole thing was an infomercial trying to, it was a psyop trying to make us litter less. Can you believe that?
I am furious that they tried to trick us into littering less using Santa of all people. I mean, what's Catholic about that?
I mean, nothing. Nothing really. Except for, I think one of the Santas may have been the Pope. And as well as you got one Santa's the Pope, one Santa's the Premier of Finland, and one Santa's Jesus, I think. Makes sense to me.
Wait, Jesus was at his own birth as a wise man?
Well, yeah. I mean, who do you think John the Baptist was?
So Jesus was caught in one of those like time loops where like you end up like giving birth to yourself.
Yeah, it's like in Metal Gear Solid. It's a time paradox.
Time paradox.
Time paradox.
God damn it. I think I hate Christmas.
Now that can't be true. Come on, get in the spirit. It's the season of brotherly love and giving. Don't you like getting gifts? Aren't you a good boy or girl?
You know, I like receiving things, but I don't really like the Pope.
So who is Santa Claus? In this continuity.
Well, you know, any kind of saint. These saints.
They just keep marching in.
As a good American, I'm a Protestant, obviously. I reject earthly miracles. They are tricks of the devil. Catholicism is clearly incorrect. We are a reformist country. Martin Luther, etc. So obviously Santa, instead of being a saintly being of mercy, is of course a harbinger of the Antichrist.
Well,
and so I reject this entire premise. And also, recycling is bad. Littering is good, actually.
Littering is good. Recycling is bad. Fuck the Pope.
Fuck the Pope. Santa's the Antichrist. I think we've covered everything we need. Did you just tell us the entire plot of this anime?
Well, it was only one 22-minute episode, so...
Oh, okay.
It was a tight 22 minutes, which, you know, gives it a lot of points in my mind.
Yeah. It only took 11 minutes to tell the entire plot.
Now, I don't know about you, but this anime has put me into the gift-giving mood, so why don't we take a break, and when we get back, we can tell you folks about Anime Death Spiral's top Christmas holiday gifts to give out this season. How does that sound?
Great.
All right, and we're back. As I was saying before the break, I've been watching all these Christmas anime. I've been getting in the Santa spirit, the giving mood. And I want to just, you know, run past some pitches here of gifts that I think would be the perfect thing to get your anime loving friend, loved one, or hated one this holiday season.
Yes. Now, before anybody complains, we know that anime itself is not kosher, so we're just going to skip over Hanukkah completely. Okay, continue.
Damn, dude.
Hey, I didn't make the rules.
All right. So first one I've got here is for the stoic in your life, the real brooding intellectual man. This is, in fact, something that I would hang proudly on any one of the three walls in my house. This is a velvet painting of Guts from Berserk swinging his big Zord, his big old Zord, and it is backlit and border lit by purple neon light. This is classy. This is refined. This sends a very clear message of interior decor to any paramours that you might have over that you want to impress.
Paramours?
Yeah.
Now, why would I ever buy this from the Crunchyroll website when this is clearly like $15 on the front page of Alibaba or AliExpress? Excuse me.
No, you don't understand. This isn't something cheap. This isn't, you know, some trash that you'd pick up in the ocean like a Santa.
Is this frame even from the manga? This doesn't even look like it's...
First of all, this is one of the final pieces of artwork by Kentaro Miura before his unfortunate passing. He did hand paint this in velvet himself, and he blew the neon glass border. So his DNA, his literal DNA, is all over this piece of artwork. This is a piece of history that you can hang lovingly, glowingly above your head, so that any person that you unfortunately trick into going into your disgusting stain-filled bedroom will know that at the very least you like Berserk.
Now I'm seeing some complaints on the page about the LED light being so incredibly bright you can't sleep with it on and you have to unplug it. Is that going to be a problem?
No. You can find polarizing glasses, sleep goggles that can block out this kind of light. It's all easily solvable stuff. Put it on a timer. Who cares? It can be yours. It can be yours for the low price of $149.99. And that's in American dollars, not yen.
Now, again, this is essentially a print that would be on a mouse pad for $12 on any Temu, AliExpress, Amazon, Etsy. Why would I spend $150 on this version?
Wow, Remy, I didn't know that you hated Berserk that much. You must really hate Berserk to not want to buy this. Is that how you want to advertise yourself to the world as someone who hates Berserk?
I mean, I don't want to advertise my love of anime to the world in general, so...
You say on your anime podcast.
Hey, I said no real names and you immediately disobeyed me. Okay, I'm sorry, but I'm unfortunately vetoing you. This is bad. This is bullshit. It's a bad piece of art. It's a bad selection of Berserk artwork. It's tacky. It's $100 too much for what it actually is. And apparently you go blind if you leave it on in your apartment. So I think this is going to be a big no.
Well, so what you're saying is that you'd pay $50 for it.
I'd be a lot closer, but you're going to have to move on here. Do you have anything else in your bag here, Santa?
I'm going to count that one as a sale, but yes, I do. Take your peepers and put them on this. This one, you got to love. You're the One Piece guy. Check it out. We all love a good, cheesy Christmas pattern sweater. Cable knit sweater with candy canes and snowflakes and little Santa faces. And, I don't know.
We all work a soulless office job where the only activity outside of staring at spreadsheets all day is creating weird little rituals to interact with your coworkers.
Yeah, like Wacky Sweater Fridays or something, right?
Yep.
And this is perfect. This is perfect for that kind of meandering, gormless existence. This is your very own One Piece Christmas sweater, emblazoned, lovingly, by hand, run machine, with the images of the devil fruits from One Piece across the waist and chest, and some text on the sleeves, which I'm going to assume says One Piece in Japanese. But I cannot read Japanese, so I will not verify that.
But you're going to take a guess anyway.
I'm going to take a guess at it anyway and say that it probably says One Piece. And this is, I would wear this proudly on any occasion year round. Are you saying you wouldn't?
Well, let me take a look here. So, I'm seeing the gum fruit on there. I'm seeing the op fruit. What is this guy? We've got Ace's flame fruit. We've got the Hito fruit. What else is here?
And this guy's dropping fruit knowledge.
We got a lot of fruits on here. Some of these I don't recognize. There seems to be a version of the gum fruit that it has like a grass top that I've never seen before. I guess that means I'm not a big enough One Piece fan to wear this sweater.
Oh man, you're dropping One Piece cred points right now.
If I wore this sweater and somebody like called me out for not knowing all the fruits on the sweater, I would have to kill myself on the spot.
Now, I do want to point out that it does have 0 stars, but only as an effect of having no reviews, which we both know is basically the same as having 5 stars with an infinite amount of good reviews. That's how math works.
I will say it looks like they just put devil fruit on top of a regular ugly Christmas sweater. I don't see how the rest of these designs kind of like match up into the One Piece universe. Seems to be just generic snowflake type shit. Fucking snowflakes.
Well, it has little anchors at the bottom, right?
That's one way to interpret that, I suppose.
Hey, I don't know what more could you want? What more could you want out of this? This is the perfect holiday sweater. I'm going to stand by this one. In fact, I just bought you three.
They've only got the small size.
I mean, you best start shrinking then, because this is non-refundable.
They must be flying off the shelf, if that's true. I mean,
I think it's no surprise that the 3X and the 4X were the first to go.
Now, why did you choose this one over the Naruto Shippuden Akatsuki holiday sweater?
Well, obviously because the superior design and quality of this one. I would never advertise that I've seen Naruto.
You think that's hokier?
Oh, absolutely. You may as well combo it with the shirt saying I'm part of the Naruto Runners Club in high school, which is another Crunchyroll exclusive product. It's on there. Check it out.
Okay, you don't believe the ethos of the ugly Christmas sweater extends to the thematic element of the ugly Christmas sweater?
No. I think that there's lots of different elements that go into making a quote-unquote ugly Christmas sweater, which I don't know why they call them that. I've never seen an ugly one. They all look awesome and totally not.
Well, this one is ugly. You're looking at one right now.
This one is an ugly sweater.
It
belongs in a museum. This is high art. You could see someone like Megan Thee Stallion wearing this to the gala in New York. You know, the big one. The big gal.
Sure, or Meghan Markle.
Yeah, wearing it to Christmas with the Queen.
Or Megan Mullally. Megan Fox would wear this on one of her dates.
You're doing Megan's. I get it.
Machine Gun Kelly.
I don't want to get into the political sphere of Megan's. Okay. All right. I got one more here. One more gift that I am sure is going to spark Christmas cheer and joy in you, and you're saying, yes, that's the one, that's the perfect gift.
Okay, but it better be anime.
Oh, it's anime, all right. It is in fact a 1/7 scale vinyl plastic figure model of Mima Kirigoe.
Okay. You're pitching this again. I told you last time, with this is not a good gift for anybody. You're still hung up on this one, huh?
I'm trying to tell you it's ironic. This is not just a clear, crass commercialism applied in defiance of a film's message. No, this is extra media commentary, right? This is highbrow stuff. It's not just for weirdos to jerk off over on their desk after Christmas alone, even though it does, for some reason, put her in this, you know, compromising kneeling position where you get a full shot of everything, you know?
Well, this is the image from the movie.
I mean, yeah.
You're putting me in a position where I have to defend this awful piece of memorabilia, but I mean, there is a reason that
she's posed
that way. Okay, so
you are pro Mima figure in this argument. I just want
to
be
frankly. There are so many reasons not to be. I mean, even putting behind us the entire concept of a Mima doll to begin with, it's not even articulated.
No, it is a static figure, a statue, yeah. If you will, a statuette.
This is a figurine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I was going to get one, I would at least get the one that you could, like, move the arms and legs.
Listen, it's art, okay? And it's not crass, and it's very cool, and I think that you should get one for your mother. I think she'd appreciate it.
Yeah, you could put it right next to the Totoro doll.
Yep. Would it be better if it was a 50-pound plush Mima? Instead of a vinyl statue?
In some ways, yes. Absolutely, it would. Absolutely, it would. Now, again, I have to wonder why the Mima doll and not this sexy Sadako from The Ring, where she's doing a sexy pose floating above a pile of destroyed videotapes. Don't tell me this one didn't catch your eye.
I don't think I scrolled down far enough to find that one.
This seems, I mean, purely from an aesthetic standpoint, this seems superior in every way.
You know, I've gotta admit, it's got the Mima statue beat conceptually in every aspect. You're right. I'm shifting tone. This year, it's all about sexy Sadako. That's where we're leaning.
Sexy Sadako. That's where we're at. Now, she never actually looked like this in any of the movies. There was never a flirty Sadako in any of the movies that I saw. So we are diverging dramatically from the source material. But you know what? I consider that a plus.
Well, I don't think there's anything to respect from the source material. Let's be honest. The Ring, a whiff in the cultural memory.
He's getting lost in the sauce. He doesn't even know what he's saying anymore. Like, we got to wrap this up before he goes on. Goes on to say something he really regrets.
I regret so much already.
Let's go ahead and call it.
All right, that was it. Those were my Christmas 2024 anime gift suggestions. You know I'm right. You people, the people out there know I'm right. Go give them to your loved ones. They'll love it. And they will totally respect you.
Uh-huh. Yeah, year two of whiffing on this entire season. Great.
All right. Okay. All right. I think we've run on far enough. Go do the stuff, like, subscribe, YouTube, yeah. Blue Sky, TikTok.
Do all this stuff.
Handsome, beautiful, tall listeners, we hope you have a Merry Christmas, a Happy Hanukkah, and an absolutely dog shit New Year. Go fuck yourself.
See, what did I say? What did I say? High on his own supply.
Oh, shit, I did it.
He's going.
I did the thing,
yeah,
right there.
He just did the thing. I will, as punishment, I will be sending you this bunny girl jewelry statue. And I'm going to make sure your wife opens it.
Okay, all right.
Bye. If Krampus is real, then Jesus is real. I mean, that's definitive proof. Not sure what the connection is, but if not directly, they are parallel to each other.